Bladder Delivers podcast, and today I am discussing bladder health with pelvic floor physical therapist, Dr. Alicia Jeffrey Thomas. Have a listen.
Hi!
Hi!
How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. The weather in Houston is amazing right now, so we're taking advantage of it as much as we can, so...
Awesome. Yeah, we've got a pretty good like New England fall day today too. So
yeah. Excellent. Well, I am super excited to have you on. This is Dr. Alicia Jeffrey Thomas. You may have seen her on Instagram at the Pelvic Health Ladies, but you may know her as Scramble Jam on TikTok. Yes. That's how I found her. And I love your TikToks. I think they're amazing. They're very educational. Obviously you're probably the coolest one out there. So they're going to be a hat on your tail. I'm just warning you. Pelvic floor PT world, but I think you're up for it. So
yeah,
you guys can find her on TikTok at Scramble Jam. I just got to have you. Where did that name come from?
So, my initials for my maiden name, Alicia Madeline Jeffrey, that's, if you scramble them up, it's Jam. And that was, you know, like my original username from like the AOL Instant Messenger days. So I just carried it forward.
Well, it's really, really cute, and it really sticks out, so I love it. So, okay, so what we're going to talk about today is all things bladder. I've been doing a series with different pelvic floor PTs about pelvic floor PT issues or pelvic floor issues. Why did I do that? I think it's something that needs to be talked about more, and the focus on pelvic floor physical therapists needs to be made because women need to know about more about what you guys do. So that's kind of what I've been doing here for several weeks. So today, though, with you, I'm going to talk about the bladder.
Yeah.
So let's jump right into it. So most women might have an idea of what the pelvic floor means. But first, tell me what it means to have a pelvic floor. What is the pelvic floor? And why is the bladder, how is the bladder involved in the pelvic floor?
Sure. So basically, I did go get my pelvis from work. Okay. So
perfect.
So you have a set of muscles that basically are at the base of your body. So they run from your pubic bone in the front all the way up and around to your tailbone in the back. So they essentially form like a hammock that are supposed to hold up your internal organs. They're supposed to open and close for bowel and bladder function. They work with sexual function. They work with your core for core stability. So they're very kind of intricately related to all things down there. Mm-hmm. Particularly when it comes to the bladder, they, like I said, they have this kind of inverse relationship between the bladder muscle controlling when the bladder itself is mm-hmm. filling and emptying, and the pelvic floor kind of acts as the gatekeeper to open and close.
Yeah. So one thing that I think is not commonly known is that the bladder does have muscle in it. So, yes. You know, and the urethra, if you think of the bladder like a little balloon, the urethra goes and that's where you pee out of. That is kind of regulated by the pelvic floor muscles, which are kind of like a sling. And mm-hmm. then the muscle itself is composed of a layer of muscles.
So, hold on one second. Okay. Let me pull my dog out. Hey. out. Sorry. I thought
it's okay.
Was going to be really nice and quiet.
So, yeah, they're like kids. They're never going to behave when you're doing something. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. So I think it's important to know that there's two types of muscles or two sets of muscles that are important for regulation of bladder control. What's actually in the wall of the muscle and is also the pelvic floor. Yes. So one of the things that I've known about because I'm an OBGYN, you know about because of what you do, is how the effect of pregnancy has on the pelvic floor. We commonly were taught that you had to have pushed out a gazillion babies before your pelvic floor is affected. It wasn't really affected with cesarean sections, but now we're knowing that's not necessarily true. We know that the pelvic floor, the musculature of the pelvic floor can be affected in women who have never had a vaginal birth, but have had pregnancies. And we also know it only takes one that you push out vaginally to have some issues with your pelvic floor. So why is that?
So, I mean, basically think, you know, the pelvic floor isn't the thing that pushes out the baby. It's the thing that needs to get out of the way.
Out of the way.
And so, you know, what we need to think about is all the stress that comes along with giving birth, right? It has to stretch and get out of the way in a relatively short amount of time after it's already been under all of the strain of carrying around the weight of this growing tiny human, you know, and your organs and everything else shifting around as that process goes on. And so it's a big stressful situation for the body. And so, you know, that can affect your bladder function, your bowel function, sexual mm-hmm. function, all of those things, because you're, you know, sometimes our bodies don't necessarily keep up with the demands that we're asking from it in that short period of time.
Yeah. And the pelvic floor muscles are just like any other muscles. The more in shape they are, the better functioning they are. And if you think about it, if we're lifting weights in the gym, I mean, the muscles of the pelvic floor, just like any other muscles you would exercise. So that's where you guys kind of come in. But I wanted to first, but when we'll get to that, but I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of the common symptoms, you know, of women who have been pregnant, whether they delivered vaginally or not? What are some of the more common symptoms? And I will preface this by saying, you know, you're ruling out any other, you know, infectious cause, anything else that might be causing bladder issues, but just say nothing else is there and we're thinking about maybe there's something going on with the pelvic floor. What are some of the more common symptoms that women might have when they're having issues related to bladder function because of a potential issue with the pelvic floor?
So yeah, I mean, so the big things that you're going to see in someone that's been pregnant, stress incontinence is the big one. So that's leaking with coughing, laughing, sneezing, exercising, those types of things. Anything where an increase in pressure in the body, the pelvic floor can't keep up with. And so therefore we have leakage from the bottom. You can also have urgency and frequency issues, which can range from just going to the bathroom really frequently to not being able to make it there in time and even having urge incontinence where we leak before we get to the bathroom.
And then also obviously pain. You can't have pain with urination as well. And obviously after ruling out that it's not from a urinary tract infection, it could be from the pelvic floor. Yeah. I know I have had one pregnancy with twins. And the one thing I have is I feel like I have to go, like I have the urgency and then I go and I'm not, I just barely pee. It's not like I don't have a lot there. I would expect I'm going to like have a liter, but I don't. So, and that's just from one twin pregnancy that I delivered by cesarean section. So I'm pretty sure there's something going on with my pelvic floor and it probably is. So just to give you an example, it can happen with even one pregnancy that may not have delivered vaginally. Okay. So we talked about what the pregnancy can do to the bladder. So let's talk a little bit more about it more. One of the first things that we talk about when a woman is pregnant is that you're going to have to go to the bathroom more frequently. And the reason for that from a physiological standpoint is that your GFR or your glomerular filtration rate or your renal function starts to get ramped up a little bit. So that's common to have urinary frequency where you're going more. Plus we're telling you to hydrate more. So you're wanting to drink more water, which is obviously going to cause more, more trips to the bathroom. But what are some of the more thing? What are some of the things that when, as you get pregnant and you get further along, and I'm sure you see patients in your practice that are pregnant and have these issues, what are some of the problems you might see throughout the course of your pregnancy that might be affecting the bladder?
So, I mean, definitely if you, you know, you'll start to notice the frequency just from, you know, A, the things that you talked about already, but then also just the physical pressure on the bladder itself. You know, it's that theory of stuff, basically, where there's only so much room. And at a certain point, you know, your bladder may feel like it's not able to fill up as much before it sends that signal to empty. You may feel a sensation of heaviness or pressure around the bladder, you know, different things like that as pregnancy goes on. And then, like I said, some people may even start developing things like leakage even during pregnancy, not even necessarily delivery.
Well, about the leakage thing there, I see, especially towards the end of pregnancy, 32-ish weeks and on, or even sometimes before, especially if a woman's had more than one pregnancy, many times someone will come in thinking they broke their water and it wasn't water. They broke it. They urinated and it's nothing to be embarrassed about. It happens. And it's always better to get checked out to make sure that you didn't break your water and that it is, you know, was in fact, that everything's okay in that regard, but it does happen. And another thing that I brought up in a previous discussion is we have a lot of women with urinary symptoms. And as obstetricians, when a woman is complaining of painful urination, pressure or pain in the suprapubic pain is what we typically hear. A lot of times we will empirically or just go ahead and start them on antibiotics while we're waiting for the urine culture. The reason for that is we don't want to wait and the urinary tract infection get worse and actually potentially get up to the kidneys, which it can happen. And we usually wait for the urine culture to get back. Now, most of the time there is something legitimately there as far as bacteria, but a lot of times it's actually negative. So, you know, the women are actually having symptoms that might be similar to a urinary tract infection, but it's actually probably for more from the pregnancy. So what can be done, and as long as the urinary tract infection has been ruled out, what can be done from a physical therapy perspective to help kind of manage those symptoms that she might be feeling?
Yeah. So basically, if you think about it, the pelvic floor and the bladder sit really close to each other. So if I kind of take my little model and break it apart, you can see, right? So we've got the bladder sitting right here and we've got the pelvic floor sitting right here. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we'll feel that sensation of maybe a muscle spasming or something like that, that gives us the sensation almost that we feel like we have to go to the bathroom, but it may not actually be the bladder itself. It may be that the pelvic floor muscles are in this state of dysfunction. Yeah. It's kind of sending a false alarm. So from a PT standpoint, what we can do is figure out whether basically what our best strategy is for managing that. Is it that the muscle is really hypertonic and guarded and we have to figure out how to relax that muscle appropriately, relax the autonomic nervous system to allow that feedback loop back and forth between the two of them to kind of calm down a little yeah. bit? Or is it a matter of, okay, maybe we need to strengthen the pelvic floor a little bit to kind of help give some guidance to the bladder, like, hey, we don't need to be sending this urgent signal all the time and kind of keep it in check a little bit. So that's kind of where the exam part comes in and figuring out, you know, what end of the spectrum we're on.
So Kegels don't cure everything. Kegel exercise, you know, we hear that. I'll just do Kegels or Kegels, however you say. Just there's this been this common misconception, I feel, and maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, that we just tell them you need to do more Kegels or before you get pregnant, during pregnancy, after pregnancy. First of all, tell me what it is and why has it gotten this reputation of kind of being a cure-all and why is it not the cure-all?
Right. I mean, so basically think a Kegel or a Kegel is a pelvic floor contraction. So if people think about trying to, you know, the sensation of trying to stop your urine or the sensation of trying to pull something into the vagina. So it's a voluntary muscle contraction, similar to how you would contract your bicep muscle, right? Mm-hmm. But for the same reasons, we don't treat everything going on with your shoulder by giving you bicep curls, you yeah. know? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of this, like, that's what we know of. And so mm-hmm. that's what we go to, but it's a much more dynamic system than that. Yeah. We, you know, yes, we can look at the pelvic floor and we can say, maybe you have weakness, but is it just weakness in the pelvic floor? Or do we also have hip weakness, abdominal weakness? How is all of that supposed to be talking to each other? And then you can also have people on the other end of the spectrum where their muscles are just so tight and guarded yeah. all the time that Kegels would be the opposite of what we yeah. want to do, because you'd essentially only be moving from here to here. And what we really need to be doing is saying, okay, let's do a range of yeah. motion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to put that out there because there was an opportunity, but you know, even back when I was training, that was the one go-to we would tell, you know, we're trained to tell patients, do more Kegel exercises, but we know now that, especially with you guys in the pelvic floor PT arena, educating more that it's much more involved in that. And that's not the cure-all for everything related to bowel dysfunction, bladder dysfunction, you know, vaginal pain, painful intercourse when it comes to women and especially those who have had pregnancies and childbirth. So yeah. I think it's a good point to make that if someone's telling you just do more Kegels and you're having issues, you might want to go see someone like Alicia so that she can evaluate you and let you know what exactly you do need to do for whatever the problem is that you have.
Yeah, because even yeah. if, I mean, even if Kegels are the appropriate thing for you yeah. to do, most people aren't necessarily doing them correctly. And it's usually the people that are the most confident that they're doing them appropriately and correctly that are squeezing everything but their pelvic floor.
But the pelvic floor, yeah, yeah. That would be me, probably. That would be me. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more specifically about some of the, you know, once a woman delivers. And, you know, some of the things, and I'll just put some of the risk factors for having pelvic floor dysfunction, and specifically with pregnancy. You know, the more pregnancies you have, the larger the babies you have, the more vaginal deliveries you have, the longer you pushed with each pregnancy. If you've had episiotomies or other types of tears that affected the perineal area or even worse into the vaginal vault, all of those things can affect the function of your pelvic floor. So there are certain risk factors that put women at increased risk for having bladder dysfunction after they deliver. And the other thing you have to think about is pelvic organ prolapse. Yeah. And that's where the uterus and cervix can prolapse into the vagina. And that can also affect your bladder. I remember seeing a 21-year-old who had her second baby vaginally, and she had significant prolapse.
Yeah.
There is a thought, and I'm not an expert, but right, there could be somewhat of a genetic component to that for the women that had the worst prolapse earlier or and issues with the pelvic floor earlier.
There is some, yeah, there's definitely some like evidence talking about that. Yeah.
Talk about that. Yeah. I think there needs to be more research into it. And it's hard to definitely associate a genetic component with anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, for her at 21, I mean, that was pretty significant. So after someone delivers, and they're having issues with any of the above things we've talked about with the bladder, what are some of the things that you can do in the meantime to help get her prepared, especially if she's not finished with her childbearing and she's planning on having more kids?
Yeah. I mean, so definitely, you know, if we have prolapse, for example, and we're trying to avoid any kind of surgical option or anything like that until they're done having kids, looking at things like a pessary is, you know, can be a great option for kind of helping to keep things supported. But also with regards to pelvic floor physical therapy, we can look at, okay, how do we, you know, retrain the bladder? That can be a big thing, talking about, you know, the behavioral component of teaching your bladder how to respond appropriately, teaching your pelvic floor how to talk to your bladder, how to, you know, work cohesively with your core, with your hips, with everything else to reduce leakage, reduce that downward pressure sensation, and kind of find that homeostasis, if you will. And there's a lot that we can do from a strengthening perspective, from a stretching perspective, from just a behavioral re-education perspective.
Well, you mentioned the behavioral education perspective, because I can imagine it's not just the exercise part. It's kind of probably some lifestyle changes.
Oh, absolutely.
Correctly. So what would be some of those lifestyle changes or behavioral changes that you mentioned?
So, yeah. So, and it depends on what specifically we're looking at. So for a, urgency, frequency, overactive bladder type scenario, the first things that we take a look at are, okay, what are, I mean, we get an idea of what our normal is right now. So if we're going to the bathroom every hour, how can we slowly start to increase that? And so we look at things like, okay, well, what are we drinking? You know, what percentage of what we're drinking during the day is water versus other things like bladder irritants? And then we look at how you're drinking water. Are we guzzling a whole bunch all at once, or are we restricting our fluid intake when we know that we have to go somewhere? Like, those things aren't necessarily the best to be doing, because we want to kind of give your body, like I said, that kind of homeostasis that, like, it knows what to expect at all points of the day, so that it's less jumpy. And, you know, we can look at things like, habits and how those affect the pelvic floor. If we're used to just in case peeing every time we leave the house, or, you know, anytime we pass by a toilet, there's the, like, never pass up porcelain crowd. and that can really be training our bladder to send that signal to urinate more frequently, more urgently over time. So there's all kinds of stuff that we can work through and kind of figure out, like, all right, where are little cracks that we can fill in to try to make the bladder and the whole rest of the body just function a little bit better.
Yeah. And so for the overactive bladder, so that's typically going to be where you're peeing a lot. Is there an urgency component to that as well? For the overactive bladder?
Yeah. So the three kind of hallmarks of overactive bladder are an urgency to urinate, frequency of urination, and then getting up at night to urinate.
And then you also mentioned bladder irritants. Let's talk about, what are some of the more common bladder irritants?
So the big ones that I usually talk about with my patients are things like coffee and tea. So caffeine, alcohol can be a bladder irritant. And then the other one that people normally don't think of or get angry at me when I mention is carbonation.
Is what?
So carbonation. So that's everything from soda to, like, seltzer water.
Water. So anything with carbonation.
Anything with bubbles. It's one of those things where I've run into it enough times where people are like, oh no, I'm drinking plenty of water. I'm drinking 64 ounces a day. And then it somehow comes up that it's seltzer, and we change that, and they notice a significant improvement, like, almost immediately.
Yeah. So when you're treating someone with an overactive bladder, you kind of have to look at their lifestyle. You have to look at what they're eating and drinking. You kind of have to look at the whole picture, because in they have to be freely giving of that information so that you can advise in the best way. So it's not all, and yes, of course, physical therapists do train about the different exercises and things to strengthen the pelvic floor, but you can't do that, you know, just by itself. You have to kind of do the whole wellness picture, right?
Right. Exactly. So, you know, I talk about it as an inside out and an outside in component, We got to make sure that everybody is working together to give it the best chance possible.
Yeah. Well, and then I'm never asking anybody this question. What is the difference between just going to a physical therapist, but going to a pelvic floor physical therapist, besides the obvious? I know pelvic floor means you have, but how are you guys different, and why should women or men, but we're talking more about women here, that are having either bladder issues, bowel issues, or, you know, sexual function issues, why should they seek out a pelvic floor PT specifically?
So the pelvic floor physical therapist is going to have extra training in bowel function, bladder function, the pelvic floor muscle evaluation and treatment. So in, you know, PT school, what you get ranges There's some people that get a pelvic floor elective, but most of us have a couple of lectures on, hey, this is the pelvic floor. Pelvic floor physical therapy is a specialty. They treat bowel and bladder function. And like, that's about what you get.
Okay.
And so when you decide that you want to specialize in pelvic floor PT, you can take a few different routes to doing that. There are continuing education courses. You can have clinical internships. You can do a residency, but there's a ton of extra specialization that goes into it that you're just not getting from someone who went to PT school and is working in an ortho clinic.
Yeah. So I think it's important that if you are listening and you have these issues, that you just specifically look for someone who did some extra training for the pelvic floor specifically. That's like, you know, going to just anybody to do, you know, we got to look at our specialty when we go to the doctor's office. The same thing is for physical therapists as well. So it's very important to kind of see, make sure that person has done extra training and is a pelvic floor physical therapist. Okay, so let's go to, next topic is going to be urinary incontinence. And I just want to say here, of course, it's a taboo topic because it's embarrassing. Nobody wants to ever admit that they're leaking urine when they cough, sneeze, move too quick, or they can't make it to the bathroom, or they're having to wear pads. But I want women to, it's easy for me to say, don't feel that way. I would feel that way too, but I'm pretty sure I would want to get help for it because it can restrict your life and your quality of life. And it can affect, you know, your day-to-day activities, whether you're working, taking care of kids, or doing anything else. So getting these issues addressed with urinary incontinence is what it's called, is extremely important. So now that that's out of the way, and there's nothing to be embarrassed of, I just want to say there's nothing to be embarrassed of. It's just like if you had anything else medically wrong, you shouldn't be more hesitant to go get treatment for that than anything else and talking to your doctor and your physical therapist for that. So let's talk about, you know, urinary incontinence. There are, of course, there are surgical procedures that can be done in women, but usually you don't want to go to the surgical route until you have decided that you're not going to have any more kids, right? So this is where pelvic floor physical therapists could come in. So what are some of the things that you can do or recommend doing for someone that their chief complaint or their main complaint is having urinary incontinence?
So, yeah, I mean, so when we take a look at this person holistically, we figure out what are the exact things that are causing you to leak. Is it with coughing and sneezing? Is it when we're exercising? And if so, like what type of exercise are we doing? Because we have to figure out, is this purely a strength issue? Is this a timing issue? Is it a coordination issue? You know, because some people will say, oh, I have, you know, I leak when I run, but it's not the initial impact. Like they can start running, but once they hit mile, you know, one and a half or something, then they start having issues. And so that person I'm going to treat completely differently than somebody who leaks immediately when they do any kind of just plyometric thing right off the bat. So, you know, we're looking at the pelvic floor, we're looking at your core, we're looking at your body mechanics and how everything kind of stacks up, because you can't just look at the pelvic floor in isolation. You have to look at everything else around it that's moving.
Yeah. So. And I'm sure the whole lifestyle changes and behavioral changes too would also play in when it comes to urinary incontinence as well. So yeah, of course, like, again, I said, there's things that can be done surgically, but the best time to do that is not, you know, if you're planning on having any more children, because you don't want to damage anything repairs that were done. So,
And also you got to think about it too. Even if somebody wants to go the surgical route, it's still better to do some physical therapy beforehand, because you're addressing kind of any of those underlying movement patterns or anything else like that, that are contributing to the continued leakage. Or if they have prolapse, that developed not even from having kids, but maybe from like chronic straining with bowel movements, you know, we need to get that under control before we ever think about doing something surgically. Otherwise we're putting that repair right there at risk again.
That's true. So yeah, to get your pelvic floor and everything else in top tip top shape before any surgical procedure would be ideal as well. So just always keep that in mind. You know, I think that I'm not in that realm. I do maternal fetal medicine, so I don't deal with women that have pelvic floor issues anymore, but I would think that if before suggesting a surgical option for treatment of anything like that, that seeing a pelvic floor PT to get assessed and start some treatment that way before even thinking about the surgical procedure would be ideal. Yes. That's just me. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then here's a good one. Interstitial cystitis.
Yes.
I know about it because my mom has it and she's dealt with it for years. I think a lot of women have it. They don't really talk about it so much, or maybe they have it. They don't realize it. But what is interstitial cystitis?
Yeah, I mean, so interstitial cystitis or IC is usually how people mm-hmm. will talk about it. But it's basically a chronic inflammatory condition. They used to think that it was completely just a bladder condition, but now we're starting to kind of look outside of the bladder and say, because it used to be categorized as if you had these lesions within your bladder known as Hunter's lesions. That was how they diagnosed mm-hmm. IC. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to see, okay, if you have the symptoms of, you know, bladder frequency and urgency, bladder pain, things mm-hmm. like that, those are the big symptoms that we see with IC. And actually 90% of people with interstitial cystitis have underlying pelvic floor muscle dysfunction as well. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely yeah. something where you get the most benefit out of seeing a physical therapist first. But the big difference between overactive bladder and IC is that pain component. And yeah. usually there's also a little bit of, you know, I talked about the basic bladder irritants. There's kind of bladder irritants on steroids for people with IC. They're more sensitive to things like spicy foods and chocolate and things like that. And it's not a one size fits all. Everybody with IC has these specific triggers, but there's a larger list of things you want to look at if you're having IC symptoms that are not being well controlled.
Gotcha. So yeah, and that is true. My mom has had suffered with the pain off and on throughout the years, but my mom's also not the most compliant patient, so I will say that. But you know, I you know, and the thing that it's important, again, and since I brought it up, is being compliant. I mean, you're going through all of this and trying to be as compliant as possible and listening to the recommendations of people like providers like Dr. Jeff. Do you go by Dr. Jeffrey Thomas, or you go by Dr. Thomas or Dr. Jeffrey? Or all the above.
All the above.
You're like me. You're like me. I'm like, I don't care what you call me. Just say, hey, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, as long as, you know, we get it, what you need done is fine with me, but I'm the same way. But as long as you go to someone like Alicia, then, you know, it's, if you're going through the process of doing that, it's very important to be as compliant as possible. And I'm going to have my mom watch this, this little episode here. Okay. Interstitial cystitis. Now, you did a recent video. I don't remember if I saw it on TikTok or Instagram or both, but you were talking about how the issues with your bowels could affect your mm-hmm. bladder.
Yes. The theory of stuff.
Okay. I'm interested.
Yeah. So, all right. So now we're back to my half a pelvis, right? Okay. So you have all of your organs in here. We don't want that. There's your prolapse right there.
There you go.
So you have your bladder, uterus and vagina, and then you have your rectum back here in the back. So everything is very tightly compact. There's only mm-hmm. so much room for all of these organs to coexist, right? And so I kind of think about it as if one of these starts taking up more room, it's going to make it so that the other mm-hmm. ones don't feel like they yeah. have enough space. So if we're more constipated, more backed up, that is going to start putting more pressure onto these other organs. The bladder is going to feel like it can't fill up and expand as much, which is going to lead to urgency, frequency, leakage, things like that. You know, and that's kind of the under-addressed component when it comes mm-hmm. to bladder issues, is that we don't necessarily take a look at what's going on in the back. It's funny because you'll see when I ask patients in their evaluations, well, you know, how are your bowel movements? They're like, oh.
What is that?
Like they have this moment of like, they're not good, but why?
What does that have to do with my urine? You know, and I'm just going to digress just a little bit here. The whole thing about, listen, if I went a week and did not have a bowel movement, I'm pretty sure I would be, but Alicia, I'm telling you, I am constantly amazed about how many women will go days mm-hmm. without a bowel movement and just think it's normal. It's not normal. Okay. No. There's, you know, this is stress that it's not normal to be that constipated. And I've seen in pregnancy where it's kind of brought to light because she's coming in pregnant and she's having contractions, and even contractions I could pick up on the monitor, and we're thinking something legit major is going on. And you know what? She's just really bad constipated. Mm-hmm. You know, pregnancy makes you constipated anyway, especially if you're taking iron pills. And then the next thing I know is that, oh geez, she really has not. And then you ask, she hasn't gone in 5-6 days. So, right. You know, I can see that it can cause issues. And I'll give you another example. This is a really funny story. She's a good friend of mine now, but when she was an intern, I was training her. And a woman was pushing, and she came to me, Dr. Clark, she can't push the baby out. I think, you know, she may not be able to make it. She's been pushing for 2 hours. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check her. She had so much impaction of bowel movement that mm-hmm. I just put my hand in the vagina. I milked all that out, mm-hmm. and she had a baby.
And there you go. Yep.
She had a baby. So I get it, how the bowels can impact or affect both, you know, even when you're pregnant. And also if you're straining a lot because you're constipated, mm-hmm. that's going to cause the pressure, the internal abdominal pressure right on the bladder, which can, yep. as a byproduct, affect the bladder, correct?
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So having good bowel health is also important. So what are some of the things we could do about that?
So number one, get yourself a step stool, a squatty potty, whatever Yay! You want to use.
I love the squatty potty.
I have like Billy Mays level enthusiasm for the squatty potty. I've had one for 4 years and I tell everyone and their mother to get one.
Yep. I have one too.
Particularly in pregnancy, right? Because we know all of those things that you just talked about that can be contributing to bowels getting a little more backed up than they normally would. We all know about hemorrhoids in pregnancy. Being in a position where when you're sitting, your knees are slightly elevated above your hips is going to help to realign the colon. So
it basically imitates more of a squatting position. Like if you were to squat in the woods, as opposed to sitting at a right angle like this on the toilet. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so basically when you're seated in just a normal toileting posture, what happens is your pelvic floor muscles kind of form a kink around your large intestine. Yeah. So everything has to make an extra turn before it comes out, which means more pushing, more straining, maybe some incomplete emptying happening. When we use something like a squatty potty or a step stool, all of a sudden that muscle relaxes. We have this nice straight line for everything to exit.
So I am a huge advocate for the squatty potty. I have them in my house too. I got them when I was pregnant and I'll never get rid of it. So, and just so you know, the squatty potty was on the Shark Tank. That's how it got really, really popular. Yes. That's how I found out about it. Okay, so that's how bowel health is also important when you're having bladder issues, or how poor bowel health, for lack of a better terminology, can affect and cause bladder issues.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Okay, we're gonna take a second here, and I have some questions. So let's see who we have, what we have here. I'll go from the top. Oh my gosh, I had the worst bladder after 9 pregnancies and some losses and 3 C-sections. I'm sure you probably, I believe you. So for someone like that, I don't know exactly what your issues are, but you know, I would guess just from the C-section standpoint, and as a surgeon, what can happen a lot with a bladder with multiple C-sections is scar tissue. Sometimes I go in and I've seen women with 5, 6 C-sections and you can't tell that they've ever had a C-section, but I can see a woman do a C-section on one who's had one prior and her bladder is stuck to the uterine wall. Yeah. It's stuck to the fascia. It's stuck everywhere. And there's a lot of scar tissue there. So that can definitely affect, do you treat women that have had bladder issues after having multiple C-sections any differently because there could be that scar tissue component?
I will check the abdominal wall with everybody, mm-hmm. but I particularly will make sure that I spend a lot of time on scar mobility, mm-hmm. abdominal mobility. You know, breathing techniques can be huge when it comes to regulating mm-hmm. bladder function. So we look at all of that because I feel like a lot of times, you know, particularly with women who've had C-sections, it's like you kind of like cut things off from here down and you're like, okay, I don't know. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to think about it. Mm-hmm. And so that changes the underlying muscular patterns, even mm-hmm. if, you know, no matter, because I don't have x-ray vision, I can't see what's going on inside, but you know, that I definitely notice as a pattern. So we take a look at abdominal mobility a lot. Mm-hmm. And there are some different techniques that we can use if they have, you know, maybe scar tissue and adhesions that help the bladder to empty better when they do go to empty and things like that. So,
I am the poor bladder. Thankfully, surgically speaking, the bladder is very resilient. We can manipulate it a lot to get to do what we need to do and without injuring it, but it doesn't mean that we can prevent the scar tissues from forming. And I've seen some pretty scarred in bladders and I'm just like, oh my gosh, how did she even get through this pregnancy and not have as many issues as you know, that it seems to me like she would. So I could completely get that having multiple C-sections can definitely affect your bladder health. There's no question.
Yeah.
Let's see. Go down a little bit more. Okay. Oh, pelvic floor plus is saying now pelvic floor awareness is important. We know that. It's good. Thank you. And then someone says we look alike. I don't know. Maybe we do look alike. Maybe I think it's the eyes. We have both have big blue eyes, so maybe that's what it is.
That's probably what it is. I need to readopt my side part.
Okay. So here's a good question. How do you professionally describe an internal exam to a patient? What are the options if they don't want an internal exam? No, let's start from the top. Can all pelvic floor physical therapists do an internal exam?
If they've been trained to do so, then yes. I mean, if you're calling yourself a pelvic floor physical therapist, you should have been trained to do an internal exam.
Okay.
So that's kind of layer one. I know that there are probably some people out there, and actually I know there are some people out there that are claiming to be pelvic floor PTs that don't do internal work. And I feel like that's missing a big portion of the puzzle, right? Because if I said I'm going to examine your shoulder and I never look at it or see it move, that's, I mean, I don't necessarily know that that's the person you want to be seeing.
Yeah.
So, you know, so when, but when we talk about doing an exam for the pelvic floor as a physical therapist, I'm not using stirrups. I'm not using a speculum. I'm not using, you know, the scary stuff that people might normally get a little apprehensive about. We think about this as, okay, this is a single digit vaginal or rectal exam, depending on your anatomy. And we look at what the muscle function is. And I describe it the same way that I would describe an orthopedic exam. You want to look at what's the strength of that muscle, what's the endurance, what's the coordination like, all of those things, to see, you know, what we need to do from an intervention standpoint. Does that muscle have trigger points in it? Any of those things. So I usually, when I describe the exam to patients, I have my model and I break it down and I say, all right, we're going to go layer by layer. And if, you know, because I do see a lot of patients who have a history of trauma, who may be apprehensive about these things. And so I always tell people, you do not need to have the exam day one. You know, I think at a certain point, it would probably be really beneficial for us to do this, to have that information, right? And that's why you're coming to pelvic floor physical therapy. But that doesn't have to be day one. You just met me. I understand that. And so usually what I'll do is I'll break it down and I'll say, okay, this is what I would like to do. You know, break it down, show you all of these parts, give you that education about your anatomy. And then you tell me when you're comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And then also at every point of the process, because I kind of think about the pelvic floor in different layers, before we even go to the next layer, I say, okay, are we okay with continuing, right? It's very much a like consent, we go, consent, we go, you know, and you can withdraw that consent at any point, because I understand the inherent weirdness in all of this. And I usually kind of relate the story of, you know, when we learn how to do these exams, a lot of people go to continuing education courses or they do residencies, but how we actually learn how to do these exams is on each other in a classroom full of 40 other people. And so the awkwardness of it, like I get it and I've been there. And so I try to bro out with people and break it down for them as much as humanly possible.
Well, and I think, and I get if there's a hesitation for whatever reason to have any kind of internal exam ever, whether it's with a pelvic floor PT or even an OBGYN, I get it. I think the important thing is to let them know that you're uncomfortable with it. You don't necessarily have to go into the why. Okay. That's not really what it's about. But I would say that as an obstetrics, there are times when it's going to be essential for us to adequately evaluate you, just as in the pelvic floor physical therapy arena. There's no real way that we could put our hands on the pelvic floor without a vaginal exam, right? If that's what's necessary. But as Alicia said, it's something that can be built up to. And if you don't ever feel comfortable with it, that's fine. But sometimes that's just what they need to do in order to get a good assessment of what's going on with you. Okay. How do we find pelvic floor PTs in our medical groups? Who do we ask? I don't know what you mean by, do you know what she means by that in our medical groups?
I would assume that, so in terms of getting to pelvic floor physical therapy, first things first, I would talk to whatever provider you're closest to, right? If that's your primary care, if that's your OBGYN or your urologist, you know, they would be maybe a good resource for finding people that they've referred to before. And that's usually a good indication of people who they get good outcomes from, right? But if maybe if your provider's not familiar with referring to pelvic floor PT, you can go to websites like pelvicrehab.com or pelvicguru.com. They have a huge directory of physical therapists broken down by location. And usually they'll have a little bio of, you know, populations that they treat, how long they've been treating, all of those things. And so that can be a good way to kind of get started in terms of finding somebody.
But we have actually a second year DPT here, student interested in women's health PT. Well, you know where to find Alicia now. Go to the Pelvic Health Ladies here on Instagram and Scramble Jam on TikTok. Yes. Good. I'm glad that they're watching. Now, here's something I have not heard of, but I know Botox can treat a lot of issues. Botox injections for the pelvic floor. What's that about?
So I'll see. So my boss actually does these. Not terribly frequently, but I have seen her do them for pelvic pain. There's different injections that you can do for hypertonic pelvic floor muscles. Usually the first thing that they do are, it's a mixture of lidocaine and a couple of other things that they'll inject into the pelvic floor. And then kind of the second step above that for those really spastic pelvic floor muscles is to do Botox injections.
Well, I'm sure that you have to get some kind of something done first, because it'd be the same. Like if you're, I used to get Botox injections for my migraines.
Yeah,
and you have to fail certain types of things first in order for it to be paid. So I'm sure it's similar for anything else that Botox is being used for. But you know, Botox has many other uses besides cosmetic. And what I'm guessing is it's probably if you have trigger points in the pelvic floor, or if it's like you said, it's hypertonic and it's just not able to relax, it would help to relax that area or areas. Yeah, is that how it works? Is it they go through the vagina? I'm assuming to do these infections.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, so there's different. So there's because there's also such a thing as bladder Botox for people with overactive bladder and things like that, where they'll actually go in like via cystoscopy and then inject into the bladder while there. So it just kind of, it depends on what you've got going on, where the Botox is actually going on and how they're getting there. So
interesting. Botox is like, it can be used for anything. It can be used for anything. So I've been convinced that it's probably going to be the next cure all for everything. So,
right.
Okay. Let me see if there's any other questions. I think that's all the questions we have. Okay. Well, that's all that I had for you. Is there anything that you wanted to, that we did not mention about the bladder that you think's worth mentioning? I think we pretty much covered a lot.
I think we covered a lot. Yeah. You know, I would definitely just really emphasize to people that, like, if you're still having issues after delivery, don't think to yourself, oh, this is going to get better, because multiple studies have shown that without any intervention, if you're still leaking at 6 weeks postpartum, you're probably still going to be leaking a year later.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to make sure that we're addressing these symptoms as soon as possible, because you don't want to miss out on things like jumping on the trampoline with your kid or running after your kid when they, you know, when they go running off somewhere. And that's just part of, you know, a quality of life thing that we need to stop shaming people for seeking treatment for these things. We need to make talking about them more normal.
Yes. Yes. I agree. I think it's too much of, oh, well, it's normal. It happens to all of us. And, this is what the price of being a mom or having a kid or whatever. And it's not. I mean, it shouldn't. Anything that's affecting your quality of life to that degree is not a price that you have to pay. There's different things that we can do to address it. I will also say this, that if you're having any kind of bladder issues or bowel issues, and that could be, you think could be related to the fact that you carried pregnancies and or had them vaginally or even by C-section, or you might have scar tissue on your bladder or anything like that, and it has not been suggested to you by your primary care or your OBGYN, I'm pretty sure they can seek the help of a pelvic PT without a referral, right? In most cases?
Yeah. So most states have some degree of direct access to pelvic floor PT. So the stickiness of it is what your insurance requires. So some insurances will require a referral, but if you want to do cash pay pelvic PT, then you're obviously able to do that without a referral. So
yeah, so always start. You can start with your, and I think people don't use, and I say this every chance I get, whatever type of insurance you have, you can call them and say, who are the pelvic floor PTs in my area? Because they have that database that they know, because they know who accepts your whatever insurance that you have, right? So they can give you those names. That's a starting point. Then while you're on the phone, say, hey, what do you guys cover for this? Do I need a referral? And you can get that information. And I also want to add there too, women that are on Medicaid, of course, there are various levels of Medicaid as well. It does not mean that you're not a candidate to get help either. There are certain things that we could still use even on Medicaid. So you could still call your Medicaid provider or, you know, whoever, whatever type of Medicaid you have to see what kind of help you can get. So it doesn't mean that it's not off the table for you.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's all that I have. I really appreciate your time. I can't wait to see your next TikTok videos, especially the ones where you're wearing the poop onesie.
That so was cute. A gift from a friend, and she had no idea how well it was going to go over.
Oh, really? So she didn't do it like with the intent for you to make it. Oh,
this was 3 years ago. She gave that to me, and I dug it out of the closet when I that started making the videos this
year. Pretty cool. Pretty insightful. Okay. Well, have a good rest of your day. I appreciate your time. I think you're very entertaining. You're a good dancer, and you're very educational. So please go follow her on TikTok at Scramble Jam, and also here on Instagram at the Pelvic Health Ladies. You can find, you know, there's always a link in the Instagram bio. You can get direct information on her, on Dr. Alicia Jeffrey Thomas. So again, thank you for your time. I appreciate
you. Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on PCOS and fertility and pregnancy.